there was the actual computer itself, and then there was the tape drive. So that was the first computer I ever touched. The first one I ever owned was everybody's favorite, the Commodore 64. And I had the big 5 1/4 disk drive that was as big as the computer. So I'd sit in my room with the disk drive on the bottom and the computer on top. So yeah, that was the, with of course the classic 2600 joystick to play games on. So that was my first computer.
Okay. All right. So you had your fire was lit, I guess, for computing with your first computer at home. And it was the Commodore VIC 24, did you say? The
Commodore 64.
64. Okay. All right. Well, from there, you know, you got familiar with computing, what have you. Now, I know, you know, in undergrad, you were a civil engineer, correct? That was your background in undergrad.
Right. I started out in mechanical.
Okay.
Then
I got bored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then I got bored and thought, you know, I could do both of them. Mm-hmm. You know, combine some high-end fluid mechanics with environmental engineering and such.
Okay.
And I found out that in order to really do that, I needed to be a chemical engineer, and that was not happening. There was only one thing I liked about chemical engineering at FAMU FSU College of Engineering, and it was not the engineer. It was not the engineering courses. I'll tell you that.
Ah.
Shout out to the sisters who represented in chemical engineering, because they all had it going on. But anyway, that's kind of how it happened. Then I got tired of it, and I just wanted to graduate, and so I just settled on civil. Mm-hmm. In the course of that, you know, that's when I really got into computing.
Right. Now, you know, we did get a chance to see kind of like a migration, if you will, at the college. You know, we're messing around with, you know, Dave Francisca, you know, those guys. We got a chance. We did some first level desktop. I was doing first level support as well as Brandon. And Brandon got, you know, he had started in that area well before I did. He had started working with the VAS computers before I'd even gotten a chance to step foot in the door working with computing services up there. Now, remember, talk a little bit about the VAX days, man. You know, we had those VAX machines up there before we actually started with the Unix backbone and Unix infrastructure build out.
Well, I'll tell you, that's really where I got started. I remember sending my, using Kermit and Lynx.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, and Lynx was an old, actually you can still use it, but it was a text-based World Wide Web browser. And we had email on the VAX system, so early on, I was into that sort of stuff in terms of having an email account. And then when when Lynx sort of came along, it sort of expanded my world. Now, Kermit had different sites that you could go to, but it wasn't quite the hypertext interface of the World Wide Web that we're used to today. And even up until that point, computers had been a pretty big part what I was doing in school, because I ran a couple computer labs on campus. And so I was really hustling the whole time. I mean, I took that experience from the computer labs over at FAMU, and that's what kind of catapulted me into the position that I got, the two positions that I had gotten in with the College of Engineering. Because one thing to remember is that I had two jobs, right?
Right.
So I was system admin at the College of Engineering, but I was also the webmaster for Florida A&M University. I was the first quote-unquote unofficial official webmaster for the university.
Right.
And so that's a historical distinction that I kind of hold near and dear to my heart. And I remember the first time that I saw Java back in 1995. So when we look at this World Wide Web technology, I've definitely grown up with it. I mean, I can tell you a ton of stories about the people that I've met along the way, about how, I remember, you remember, Alpha, we would read Yahoo like every day because it was only 10 pages long.
Yeah.
You could look at everything. It's like, okay, I'm done reading Yahoo today. There's nothing new. It's all the same.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
So.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep going.
Oh, no. So that that experience in of itself was really rich for me, because having been on that VAC system and then having someone like Dave Kinsiski come in and transform not only just the computing resources at the college, but he literally transformed that college, because that is what enabled a lot of us to get the experience in terms of computing that we have today. I mean, basically there were three guys. There were three guys that essentially taught everybody how to build a web page, right? And I say three, excuse me, because I was actually number four, because Cliff Browning was the first guy.
Yep.
And the second guy, I forgot Robert's last name, but he was a grad assistant in electrical engineering, and then Ray Gilstrap.
Yeah.
So when I look at, and then Ray taught me, and then I taught John Brown, and then after that, we kind of taught everyone else. So when you look at those five people, you know, we're pretty much responsible for teaching a whole bunch of people about web technology, how to use it, and really changing the way that the college was in terms of utilizing that infrastructure. I know I taught a lot of professors how to do certain things as well. Mm-hmm. It was really an empowering sort of thing for a lot of us. Some of us jumped on it wholeheartedly, like I did. Others didn't. But, you know, even John started his own company doing this stuff. So, you know, that's a whole nother topic.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about...
Exactly. John went the route with Cold Fusion for whatever reason. He went that route. That's what he seems to prefer, but that's a whole another discussion in itself. Now, but to the theme that you mentioned, that the College of Engineering and, you know, the learning and the discovery that was taking place, you know, I recently went back to the university not too long ago. I think my cousin had graduated, and then I went down later on after that, you know, during some sort of recruiting event. And for the job, and I was disappointed a bit. I was talking with Dondo about this, because, you know, it didn't seem like, since the Unix infrastructure has pretty much been ripped out over there, it's no longer, you know, the beautiful pizza boxes that we remember sitting out there on the desks in the lab, that, you know, the Spark 1s, the Spark 5s, Spark 10s, they're gone, you know. So that whole era of learning and discovery seems to have disappeared, because it's all been replaced by Microsoft stuff. So there's not a whole lot of learning that needs to be done. Everything is done for you. It's all automated. It's all instant. There's no more hacking going on that I can see at eye level. You know what I'm saying? And it's disturbing to me. You know, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's funny you mention that, Alfred, because that's how I got my job with Dave Kinsiski. Him being the system admin he was, paranoid by nature, lazy by fault, he had been tracking my keystrokes. So it was a combination of him tracking my keystrokes, and I think the guy's name was Harry. He was one of the lab assistants.
Yeah.
And so we're sitting in the lab at our customary spots at the only four terminals that could do any web stuff. Mm-hmm. Dr. Kinsiski walks in and says, "Who is that guy?" "Oh, that's Brandon." He's like, "Well, who's Brandon?" He's like, "Man, Brandon helps everybody here. Whenever I'm in here, I don't have to do anything, because Brandon just helps everybody. He knows everything. As a matter of fact, you should probably hire the guy." So he calls me up, you know, he taps me on the shoulder, calls me up to his office. He's sitting talking. He's like, looking at his computer, looking out of his office. He's like, "I see you've been poking around the system." I'm like, "Yeah, and?" He's like, "Well, you've been poking around in some of the right places and some of the wrong places." So he's like, he offered me a job. So, yeah, there's not a lot of that going on. And part of it, Alfred, is I just think that there's just a prevailing, there's a different attitude at the school. It's a different type of kid. Like I said, I went back to Florida A&M in the spring of 2003 as a student, and they're just different. The type of student that goes to the school now is different. And I've used this term before, but they're not hustling. They're not hustling. They're not trying to figure out. They're just trying to figure out how to get through, as opposed to absorb and move forward. Now, I don't say that for all, but I just feel like things are a little different. And it may be me just being a fuddy-duddy, but I agree with you. I just think the kids are different that are going to school now. I just think they're different.
Yeah, they are different, and I think the stuff that you had taught me when I was going through the whole learning process and what have you, you know, because quite frankly, I would not have learned Unix, and I would not have an interest in learning Linux, had it not been for the fact that I wanted to understand the wide world web loop, that I wanted to build a simple web page. And during those times, as I've said previously, Microsoft didn't exist. There were no Microsoft tools. There was no Microsoft Notepad editor that you could use to do anything. You had to learn VI or Pico, you know, or Emacs if you were so inclined. So, you know, that was the whole foundation for us. And like I said, it's missing now because there is a difference, and there is the lack thereof of hunger that I see, and people want a straight hustle to learn, because that's how we used to eat, right?
Yeah, that job enabled me to buy, you know, that job enabled me to amass a 600 CD collection by the time I got out of college. That job, it basically, that experience and the people that I've helped get past that has really been, you know, it's been what I can say is the foundation of my success. But I'll tell you the other thing is that it's just the technology itself. It's the technology itself. It's the enabling power of the internet that enables so many people to collaborate a whole lot quicker, get a whole lot more done. It was a lot easier. It was, I mean, HTML versus C might as well be English versus, you know, no offense, but Mandarin Chinese. You know, C, I mean, for people to give them the ability to create, even just in the old early days,
right,
was light years ahead of anything that anybody was supposed to do. I mean, you know, what would it take for you to create a button on a screen inside of a window on a computer using C versus what it would take for you to do with web technology?
Oh, absolutely.
So when we look at that, you know, when we look at that, and again, like I said, I've seen this whole history of the internet as it's kind of unfolded. When we look to our topic for the day, not only did it enable people, it enabled a lot of people to get very, very rich. Mark Cuban, you owe me a check, buddy, because you emailed me and asked me how to do broadcast.com, and I'm looking for my check, buddy. James Woods of Columbia Music, I told you what to do about this MP3 stuff back in 96. You didn't listen to me. I want a check, buddy. It enabled industries to do a great deal of things. And I never forget a quote by, you can call him great, but one of the greatest CEOs in existence, Jack Welch of GE, basically made a statement that today doesn't get nearly the credit that it should. And basically said, want to thank the dot-com companies for helping our businesses learn the way to the future. And so in that one statement, Jack characterized the dot-com boom and bust, that essentially, instead of big corporations trying to figure out what to do for themselves, the market came to bear, the market people, common consensus of what was going on with technology helped those companies figure out how they were going to do, how they were going to engage, because there is no amount of money that they could have spent that would have given them some of the tools that they have. That same sort of idea can easily be looked at when you talk about IBM, the state of IBM in 1993-1994 relative to the rise of the internet. Again, at that time, mainframe has been deemed dead for several years now, dating back to the late 80s and early 90s.
Now, before we get into
it,
I'm sorry, not to go through, before we get into it, can you, for the benefit of listeners, can you just explain to what a mainframe is and why is it necessary?
Well, most people know about a mainframe because of the Matrix, or that's just the term for a very, very large computer that sits in a room and controls everything. But essentially, mainframe computing is the first. It's the first type of computing that was ever created, right? A lot of us know about ENIAC and UNIVAC, maybe, but those were all basically precursors of the common mainframe you have today. But even still to this day, the mainframe holds 80% of all the world's information that's on a computer. And so in some way, shape, or form, the mainframe or a mainframe touches your life. Anything dealing with the financial industry, anything dealing with transactions between businesses, all run by mainframe computers. And it's a technology that was developed and held by IBM, and they're the ones that run it. It's essentially the foundation of our entire company. We have all these other major growth areas in terms of software and services, but at the end of the day, without getting into too much trouble, I can just tell you, majority of what we do comes from, as we call it, System Z now. System Z right. hardware and System Z software.
Exactly. Okay. Now, I had read somewhere that mainframe sales last year increased greater than people had realized. They had increased, period. That's what I read last year somewhere on IBM. Mm-hmm. And I was really impressed by that. I said, wow, I mean, mainframe growth actually increased. And I was just wondering if that was, you know, at the behest of the growth of Linux in the Z series strategy, or is that with the IBM, you know, AIX infrastructure growth, or both? I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, if we talk about that sort of innovation and where IBM was about 16 years ago, about 12, 13 years ago, yes, what happened is that web technology essentially enabled IBM a way to expand the usefulness of the mainframe. When IBM decided that it would be much cheaper to focus on an operating system that was essentially free and use it as a development platform to further other objectives like bringing web technology even closer to the mainframe, when IBM came up with their Linux strategy, that was one of the tenets of it. And I believe his name is Dr. Irving Budlowski Berger. He was one of the earliest proponents of IBM's Linux strategy, as well as web technology and how we were going to leverage it in our company. And so for the Linux community, a lot of people thought, well, IBM's getting behind Linux, that's going to mean eventually it's going to get on the desktop. And I would say that that might have been the thought, but that's not the reality. The reality is that IBM, instead of relying on outboard Unix-based or even Windows-based PC commodity hardware to run Linux, they mounted an effort to bring Linux in closer to the mainframe and essentially within the mainframe create a classic N-tier application where on the back end, where the data sits being in a DB2 database on the back end, and then creating specialized processes to run Linux and create sort of a data layer and an application server layer as well as a presentation layer utilizing Linux and web technology. And what that essentially ended up doing is it extended the capabilities of the mainframe into the modern world. A lot of people, when you go on the web, you know, you have no idea what type of web server you're connecting to, but you're probably more than likely connecting to a Linux machine, and in some situations you're probably connecting to an actual mainframe. So IBM's total strategy included both hardware and software to essentially maintain the mainframe's footprint in the world. Now, the main thing that was responsible for that growth, Alfred, and to the listeners out there, and again, without getting myself into too much trouble, is the fact that IBM also consolidated their chip strategy in terms of the engines, and I'm talking about the microprocessors that actually run the IBM system.
Okay.
So not only did we create this strategy for Linux and how we were going to utilize it as a company, and that kind of goes back to Jack Welch's statement from earlier on, IBM learned, as well as many other companies, that we're going to take this free technology that we don't have to spend any research dollars to develop, none of that, this existing community of folks who happily create applications and generate ideas and quote-unquote innovation for free, we're going to just leverage some of that and use it for our own purposes. When you look at it from a cost and expense standpoint, huge amounts of money were saved. So I would say that IBM's motivation for moving into the Linux space was motivated more by the desire to keep the mainframe viable, to keep it as a viable platform that could keep up with technology, but then also to save them a heck of a lot of money in terms of creating development platforms for graphical user interfaces for these systems as well. That okay. could very be gleaned from all of that.
Okay, well, let me ask this question, and it would help clear things up in my mind, and I'm certain would also benefit the listeners as well. When we talk about, you know, a mainframe, a lot of people think of it as a supercomputer. Obviously, you know, when you can talk about the Cray as an example, you know,
right.
And some people think of it as a supercomputer. But with this whole idea of commoditization, you know, we know hardware as an industry is a commodity business. You know, it's a shrinking, you know, shrinking economies of scale allows it to be a shrinking revenue business in a lot of avenues, you know, because everybody's talking virtualization now. They're talking
right.
Hypervisor and things of that nature. We'll get into we'll get into all that. But what I want to find out from you is, you know, how do you compete against these Beowulf clusters? You know, these Beowulf clusters, which are nothing more than, you know, many, many hundreds of Linux boxes, as an example, commodity-based Intel hardware or AMD hardware, whatever you want to call it, going across the board. I mean, because that's the strength of Google's business, as an example. How does a mainframe remain relevant in that type of space?
Well, let's start with, and I'll make this a quick background, by saying there's nothing new under the sun.
Okay.
So with that, when we look at the mainframe and what it is, the mainframe as a general computer from processing power can't even keep up with some of the desktops today because of the way it's actually built. It's
okay.
It's not built for one person to actually use it. It's built as a shared system.
Right.
So when you build it from that perspective, there are very many there's concepts that come into place. And all this virtualization stuff that we're seeing, all of that technology from a concept to even implementation was pioneered on the mainframe. So you mentioned hypervisor. That's always been on the mainframe. Within the mainframe, there's several different types of operating systems that you can use that are specific to a given purpose. So for instance, there's ZVM. And basically ZVM is the reason why VMware exists. It's basically VMware for a mainframe.
Right.
On top of that, there are several other types of operating systems that you can run within the mainframe that are specialized for processing high-speed bank transactions or doing high-speed data warehousing, right? And each of those operating systems are specifically tuned to the mainframe hardware to do that as efficiently as possible. So from a pure processing standpoint, the mainframe may not be as great as, say, the desktop computer that's sitting on your lap right now or sitting on your desk, but it's a lot faster at doing a specific task than many others. And so it's much more efficient at it, and it can scale much easier, much larger than a lot of some of these systems are. The thing to keep in mind about the main difference between a mainframe and a supercomputer is that a supercomputer, its only sole job is to crunch numbers very, very fast, very, very big numbers, very, very fast.
Okay.
Mainframe could be tuned to do that, but the mainframe can do that, but then also do some other things, and can also do some other things all at the same time. And in fact, sharing it on one particular piece of disk. You know, mm-hmm. it's really simplified in that sense, but the mainframes and supercomputers do two totally different things. But in popular culture, somebody will look at a mainframe and call it a supercomputer, or some journalist will call and look at a supercomputer and say, you know, and not really know the difference.
Right.
To the general public, it doesn't matter. It's more or less functionality, what they actually do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I was just saying that the whole virtualization, a lot of the things that you're seeing now that are new and buzzwords within inside of what people would call open systems computing, it's always been in mainframe.
Okay.
And one of the big issues with mainframe is that it was a proprietary closed sort of system. It didn't allow the innovation that an open system would. But again, when you're trying to create a shared system where you're trying to balance resources between all of the different requesters, the last thing you want to do is have what you call a runaway process, which in, you know, Unix and Windows world, we have those all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it eats all the resources, but mainframe is designed so that never ever happens.
Right.
So inherent to that operating system, there's security, controls, things that aren't always available on other operating systems that protect against that.
Well, there is a little bit of a progression here that I wanted to touch on. At FAMU, you know, we had something called an IBM 4381, and that was that was the monster mother, if you would, of computers that allowed us to do our advisement, our grading, and academic advisement, that is, and some grading, and I don't know if it had to do anything with payroll or not, but I know I did a lot of other tasks. And, you know, it had those huge 8.5-inch disks and stuff. I mean, in operations, I got a chance to play with those. Well, at least, I don't know if I ever, yeah, I actually got a chance to play with some of those things over there in Perry Page. Now, that was that the S390, or was that even a little bit predated the S390? Or was that the same class of processor for that particular machine?
The 4381 was... If I remember correctly, it was just before S390, because that particular machine was pretty old.
Okay, yeah. Matter of fact, it was Deacon... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, what were you were saying?
I was saying they had this, the lottery gave that to the university, I think, the Florida Lottery.
Right.
And they had IBM decommissioned it the day after FAMU received it.
Correct. it was not new technology at all, but because of the portability of the code, because it was a closed system where things were carefully maintained and updated, it was very easy for them to transition what they had from that machine to another.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably, I would say, maybe 3 to 4 generations behind what you would consider today, because now, I mean, we just introduced the System Z10.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot smaller, a lot more efficient, and can probably outform a football stadium full of 4381.
Wow.
In terms of its processing power and its ability to do different sorts of things. And so when you look at that processing power again, mainframe's not very good at doing some of the things that a Unix box or a Windows box is able to do. So what happened is that IBM developed some specialized processing units that would specifically focus on those types of activities. Kind of like a math coprocessor that you used to have back in the old 286 and 386 days.
Right.
But essentially the way that Linux is run and even WebSphere is run on a mainframe is that you have to install these specialized processors into the box, and it's there where they actually run that open systems code. Because the other thing to remember, the other really big difference between a mainframe and the computers that we use every day is that they talk two different languages.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, we talk in 8 bits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ASCII terms, as opposed to mainframe talks in what's called EBCDIC, which is totally different. It's a different number of bits and all that kind of stuff. And just throwing these terms out, whether I know the right terms and whether the bits are correct, there may or may not be those out there who go and do a little wiki search to find out what the truth is. But essentially, it talks a totally different language, so it can't even run any of their modern open systems operating system. So that's another reason why IBM had to look at this long-term strategy in order to understand how we're going to pull the mainframe into the future. I mean, you couldn't change, you know, 80 years of mainframe technology just to incorporate that. Why would you do that? That's not good business sense. And if there's anything to get from all of this, and looking at the mainframe and how Linux got onto it, it's a classic example of how a company takes its bread and butter foundation product and slowly but surely turns it into something that essentially is going to lead the future. Because what people don't realize about mainframes is that because of their proliferation in the world, because they're everywhere, because they can talk IP, because of Linux essentially being a free development platform to enable that sort of communication, I think what you should, everyone should kind of realize is, well, now that you can run Linux on a mainframe with these specialized computers, why couldn't you do a cluster of these specialized Linux processors on a mainframe? Again, the mainframe coined the whole term of 5 nines and 6 nines reliability. Mainframe's not going down. Ask me the last time a Windows box went down, or even a Unix box.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So we're transitioning, you know, we're getting deeper into this topic. Imagine having a army of mainframes that are running Linux on these specialized processors that never go down.
Oh, yeah.
And then what can you do with that? All these concepts of Beowulf clusters and all this other sort of stuff, it's like, yeah, that's nice. But what IBM has essentially done is positioned itself in such a way that when Grid fully takes on, the best way to do it is going to be using a mainframe. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. Our new Z10 mainframe, one that's pretty tricked out, will cost you about $3 million.
Wow. Shit.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Our newest Power 6 box, right, fully tricked out, will cost you about $1.2 million. Now, some people will say, well, you know, well, I'll go for the cheaper box. Okay, well, fine. The thing is that in terms of what you would be able to do with that one mainframe, and you look at all the things around total cost of ownership, heat, you know, facilities, the new green initiatives and all that kind of stuff, if you look at it from a TCO standpoint, total cost of ownership, you may find that the mainframe might be the way to go.
Hmm. Well,
and
one
then be, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the questions I had was with this whole idea of high availability, high performance computing and stuff, because that sounds like what you are leading into. When you start talking about your 5 nines and what have you, and you're talking about your availability with a mainframe computer, what are some of the, I guess, some of the unique challenges that you may run into, or may challenges you may have that may not necessarily exist if you're dealing with something strictly like a with an Intel type of platform or Intel hardware or AMD hardware for that matter? And what are some of those unique challenges?
Well, the first thing is that, you know, the Intel, the Wintel world, Unix world, they're trying to get to 5 nines. The mainframe's been sitting at 6 for years.
Okay.
6 nines for years. So that's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that these technologies are changing, because Intel platforms, being that it's an open system, as we call it,
mm-hmm.
without standards that keep development and interfaces the same, it's always going to change. It's like, you know, we started out with ISA buses on our computers,
sure.
and then we went to Visas, and then we went to PCI, and now we've got a new one called PCI Express. In the mainframe,
well, we actually had microchannel first, though.
yeah. Thanks, IBM. Thanks, IBM, for that one. Good. Thanks for reminding me of that, Alfred. Thank you. Thank you very much. Lil, thank you very much. Okay. Nice. The mainframe, being that it was a closed proprietary system, IBM was able to maintain standards internally. I mean, they weren't open standards, but basically they kept the architecture essentially the same. And being able to work in that ecosystem, allowing for updates of that operating system and the hardware, that's really the big difference. The big challenge is that the mainframe, everything's pretty much standardized. Now, it's only one vendor that sells them,
sure.
but it's pretty much standardized, and development and the ability to put things in without having downtime is great. I mean, the mainframe was built on that. When people talk about mainframe reliability or reliability in computing, their model is the mainframe.
Right.
But because of the way the open systems world is structured, and there are no standards, there are standards, but it's not like those standards have all been additions of each other. I mean, a motherboard you bought 6 years ago cannot work in anything that you have now, as opposed to it's possible that some components that are in a mainframe that's 6 years old could work in a new one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the big challenges. That's one of the big differences. And then high availability, security, protection, all these things that we're talking about in the open world, it's already been there. So it goes back to that statement I made, there's nothing new under the sun. Everyone's trying to be like a mainframe. I mean, that's how Sun sold a gabillion Starfires and E10Ks and E25Ks back during the dot-com boom, because they were saying, these are mainframe replacements. These machines have mainframe reliability. It's like, without the mainframe, none of these concepts would exist.
Interesting. So the high availability is something that IBM is actually going to be going after, and, you know, this whole idea of replacing the mainframe is just utter nonsense. You know, there's always going to be a need for that heavy metal, for lack of better words, out there to support. Now, how does this affect, does IBM have a strategy for computing cloud? You know, because that seems to be the next great thing under the sun, where everybody wants to create this computing cloud. You know, Amazon has done a pretty decent job with the S3 computing cloud, and it seems to be something that Microsoft is running that path now, once again late as usual, as they are with everything else, but running that path now, trying to do a virtual S3. They're trying to do some, not S3, but, you know, computing cloud type of structure. Now, how is the mainframe going to be in that development, or in that particular space, if that's something that it can go or should go, for lack of terms, lack of better words?
What essentially, the thing to keep in mind is that all the data, most of the data in the world sits on the mainframe. So at some point, somebody's going to have to get to it and utilize it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a company, and the whole term of cloud computing is essentially just an outgrowth of what we know as grid.
Right.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's just grid. Cloud computing sounds a little bit more sexy than grid does.
Right.
Okay. And Google came up with it, and Google, I believe Google is the company that's been most identified with the whole idea. And because it's something new and it's catchy, and Google's a hot new tech company now, they kind of set mindshare in a way about what people think of computers. And so to me, cloud computing, all that is just, now you just have these resources that just kind of sit out there up in the cloud that you can access. Rather than using, say, a web browser to use them, you can create a program inside of a web browser, go to Cloud 9 and get a specific set of resources from it. Essentially, the best way to kind of look at that is how Google and Amazon actually have APIs into their system. The best example of it for all you iTunes people out there is that there's an application out there called our iTunes Art Importer. And basically what it does is it uses an API connection directly into Amazon to pull out album cover art that's in your iTunes collection. So when you think about the types of resources and the information that Amazon has inside of their system, you'd want to make that available to other people to use for other purposes that have absolutely nothing to do with selling the stuff that Amazon does. And
right.
So when you think about the whole cloud concept, that's one of the ways to look at it. And then under that, you may have a host of grid computers, and those grid computers may be running Linux, but then those also could be those specialized Linux partitions running on the mainframe. So it's just going to be another option for people to use to enable things like grid, and then eventually creating a cloud for whatever resources they have. Because, that's another another potential revenue stream if you're able to make some of the things you do to do what you do well available to others who can use it for a whole nother purpose.
Yeah, and that's that whole long tail that seems to be another popular term that people are using relative to added value. after the initial benefit has been perceived or understood by the mainstream, then you have those on the outside of the mainstream, outside of that bell curve, if you will, on the very edge or tail of the mainstream, people figuring out ways to mash up what's already been there and out there for other uses that weren't necessarily conceived by the mainstream.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that makes a whole lot of sense. Interesting.
And so and then one more point. IBM purchased a company called XIV.
Mm-hmm.
So you've heard a lot about how Google basically just has these computers that are just sitting, you know, all over the place. Right, this massive dense capability in terms of computers. And like, if that one computer fails, essentially, they have what I've been told is a 1U rack service. Instead of it being a full-blown computer, it's actually a highly specialized disk controller. Of course, they've got a lot of units behind this, but essentially now, they're using an entire computer as a disk drive.
Okay.
So instead of having to rely on, you know, standard, you know, RAID-type algorithms and stuff for data, that's not going to work for what Google's trying to do. So when you think about, now we're considering that an entire computer is an intelligent disk controller, and we've created software that lays over the top of that that utilizes them as such. And because we've got a full-blown operating system there, or at least a kernel, there's a whole bunch of neat little things we can do. Right? This company, XIV, that IBM just purchased, it's a similar concept in that they have a way of taking an entire computer, linking them together, and essentially doing some things that, because you have a real operating system talking to this storage, that you couldn't just do with one single computer. And that's what allows you to scale. And Linux is one of those enabling technologies making this sort of thing happen.
Sure. So it's the building materials that I like to use, that Doc Searle's term that he likes to use all the time, the building materials that is open source or free software that allows you to get the economies of scale that you need for this particular application, and also make it something that's more robust, you know, as you make improvements to it, I guess, because the code is available for you to use and do as you wish.
Right. I mean, the best way, the people who are really, really doing it with Linux are looking at Linux as if it were microcode that enables some other function to work that much better. It becomes, you can communicate with it because, again, you've got a full-blown operating system. You can use any type of communication method you want. You know, you could have it running, you know, HTTP protocol. You can have it running any kind of protocol because you've got a full-blown operating system there. And then if you really know what you're doing with the kernel, because it's open, you can strip out all the stuff that you don't need.
Right.
And create a very, very small, you know, kernel that can do some really, really amazing things. And it's that sort of innovation that is really coming about, where you're going to see people being able to do things. That's why cloud computing is going to work. Grid computing, again, was you're actually relying on those individual machines to do a specific task, and there's different types of grid, but the outgrowth of that has been this cloud idea where now cloud computing is essentially enabling the grid or the computing resources of a given company to be available to a simple interface like HTTP or some specified API that anyone can write an application to.
Interesting. So one of the things that I always wonder is, as the time progresses and we keep talking about the economies of scale, how to make things cheaper and faster, and, you know, with simple Moore's law in terms of making things smaller and smaller, and silicon smaller and smaller for more and more processes over time, and things of that nature, and of course that drives the cost down of the hardware, where do you think mainframe will go? And is it conceivable that we could have mainframes small enough to fit on, you know, our wristwatch as an example? Or wearable computers?
I think what's gonna happen is that I can tell you now that we have mainframe customers who are going from 7 engines. That's what we call the CPUs. They're buying the new Z10, and they're going from 7 engines to 3 engines because the new 3 engine mainframes are so much more powerful than the 7 engines that they had before that it just makes good sense for them to do, right? So what's happening is that I believe that the mainframe is going to be in the back end. It's always going to be a part of the infrastructure. I mean, essentially, some of our wristwatches and cell phones, like I said, from a processing standpoint, have a whole lot more power than some of the early mainframes.
Sure.
But what I think the is going to happen is that the mainframe, because of its reliability, because of its built-in security, and its long historical path of computing, it's still going to be the backbone, the foundation of computing. It's much like how we were talking a little bit earlier, Alfred, before we started recording the call, about the difference between the post office, FedEx, DHL, email, and then instant messaging. All of those particular mediums can do some of the same things well, right? You can send a message through all of those. However, different ones do different types, can deliver different types of message in that some of the stuff that you, there are things that you can't do with IM that you can do with the post office. And I create that example for people to kind of think about. Think of the mainframe as the U.S. Postal Service. It's not going anywhere in terms of computing. You know, we're going to get all these neat little nifty things and ways of communicating and such like that. But at the end of the day, in some way, shape, or form, they're going to leverage the United States Postal Service. Now, you're probably saying, well, how the heck does IM and the United States Postal Service match up? Brandon, you're kind of stretching things there. Well, you remember all those CDs that AOL used to send everybody?
Yeah.
That's yep. The single reason why people know what an IM is.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
So that's the relationship. Without the Postal Service, there's no way anybody would have known about AOL. AOL would have never been able to send out 1 million of those things, which I used for cultures back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Or reformat the floppy disk for better use.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very true. I think for the most part, the mainframe has always been that, like I said, that venerable piece of hardware that everybody always talked about, the green screen, or the thing that, you know, nobody ever wanted to work on. But every, you know, still today, I still use the IBM 3270 piece of software to interface with some of our legacy database applications that we have for warranty and stuff like that. And hell, that's a mainframe application for sure. You know, running for parts, getting parts, and even for the warranty system, it's a huge mainframe running Oracle on top, or whatever the case is.
Right.
And it's something that you just can't replace because it's very reliable, you know, and things of that nature. And it does what it needs to do, stays out of your way. Now, what I like to hear about is people porting applications over to the mainframe. There's a guy named Mark Post. He ported Slackware to the S390, and Slackware, of course, being a Linux distribution. And I think Debian runs on S390 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And probably some other flavors too. Now, the more they keep porting different operating systems over to the mainframe computer. Now, speaking of porting, now they don't port any type of Windows software over to the mainframe, right? I mean, does Windows run natively on a mainframe computer or no?
No, and that was when I was talking earlier about the specialized microprocessors.
Yeah.
It what happens is that Linux doesn't actually run on the mainframe per se. It's really, the easiest concept to say is it's almost like it's VMware, except it's like VMware with its own special processor.
So it's
really more like a daughter card. Like you remember how in PC, back in the day with Macintoshes, you could buy a full-blown board that was essentially a PC on a board.
Sure.
You could stick it into the Mac, and you'd have this separate window and such like that. So that's the best concept to kind of think of these specialized processors. And they're called Integrated Facility for Linux, or IFL. So you have these IFLs that interface directly with the mainframe, and right. you're actually running, you're running the code on this IFL.
Mm-hmm.
The IFL is interconnected into the hypervisor and the other resources that the mainframe provides, right?
Okay.
So it doesn't actually run on the mainframe. It's more or less like that daughter card situation. And then what happens is that the porting is not as, it's not really a full port. It's more or less like you have this environment that you have to change some of the ways that it interacts with it. But for the most part, they've done a pretty good job of enabling those who want to put Linux on Z to be there. And as more and more people, and then of course, when you look at it from a business standpoint, it's not going to make a whole lot of sense to support a bunch of other distributions, because that's been the main hindrance to Linux even getting accepted into the enterprise and even on the desktop. They don't have the support structures like Windows and Apple do. And so the other thing to keep in mind is that, I'll just put it pretty bluntly, why would you want to put Windows on a mainframe anyway?
Yeah.
What,
yeah, exactly.
You know, let's follow the money here. Why would you want to do that?
Yeah. Yeah, not a whole lot of benefit in doing that, you know?
No. It might run a lot better. Because it's running on a proprietary closed, you know, a proprietary hardware system, and yeah, that may not be good for innovation, but it's good for running a country and running a bank.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
It wouldn't boost BSOD on you at the least opportune time, you know.
Right. I mean, another way to look at Windows and Unix is that it's the way that you provide everyone access quickly to these mainframe resources, period.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, I think the mainframe as a rule, you know, has always been that misunderstood piece of hardware and the application is not something that people talk a lot about and that sort of thing. I'm glad that I got a chance to get you on here today to speak about it and in general terms and some specific terms as well, so that people understand how, you know, Linux on the mainframe has been thrusted out there and some of the strategies that IBM has in actually leveraging, you know, Linux on the mainframe and mainframe in general. So I think as we're on the hour, I probably need to close the show down here. But I want to thank Brandon for joining us today and giving us some knowledge, some wisdom and experience when it comes to mainframe. And Brandon, thanks for having me. I certainly want to have you on here again. We need some more time.
Oh, definitely. I enjoyed myself today, and I look forward to doing this again with y'all.
Okay.
The conversation began to take a different direction after we completed our dialogue on mainframes. We began to talk about ODF and OOXML controversy. We also began to talk a little bit about the 700 megahertz spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Something else that's not in the press. Well, not mainstream press on a consistent basis. I was looking at Mix 08 and we had that guy Kawasaki interviewing Obama. And Kawasaki was asking questions. He asked all the questions except one, which is like, how come you guys are kind of ramrod a shitty ass, you know, OOXML through some ECMO standards, you know? He didn't ask him that question. So he asked him a few others that, I guess a lot of people would have probably said too. But, I'm following, Suter pretty closely to see what, you know, his thoughts are on certain things, and also he seems to have some good ideas about standards in general that are interesting, so I kept in contact with him in that regard.
Well, that's good stuff to do, and I tell you, man, we could do at least 30 minutes from that. People don't understand how important this ODF thing is. Let's take what I do every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I back up a file 10 years ago. It's a piece of very important data. 30 years down the road, are we going to have an application that can even read that file for a minute?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that problem that problem is so huge right now. And IBM is recognized, and even I recognize it. It's like, okay, well, you don't want, we're not going to do a proprietary. Can we at least have a standard that everybody has to adhere to?
Exactly.
Because companies get bought and sold every day.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that whether it's technology companies creating these standards, or if it's Bob Plumbing and Joe's Electric, they decide to get together, well, guess what? They've got integration issues. They could potentially have integration issues that, you know, if they've got EMC storage versus somebody else, you know, they've got VAX versus you. You can't make that go together. The greatest example of it, and they're paying a dear price for it, I think, is you look at the Sprint Nextel merger.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I mean, in the whole, you know, in the whole WiMAX thing. Not so much WiMAX, but just Sprint Nextel. So IDIN, that's why Nextel was never bought by anybody. Because they had that Motorola IDIN solution, you know, network that was so different from CDMA, TDMA, you know, and GSM.
Yeah, GSM, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now tell me this though, since you got into that subject, what are your thoughts on this whole idea of this white space that, you know, everybody thought that Google was going to jump in there and eat that 700, megahertz spectrum, man, because they kept talking about that shit for a long time, how they were going to, you know, flip the script all of a sudden on the wireless, providers and make them play the game that's fair, you know, in terms of providing Wi-Fi to everyone at reasonable cost and what have you, but they didn't get on that shit. They did that to the incumbents.
Oh, no, they did. They did. Their bid wasn't good enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Google made a bid, but Verizon and AT&T went out. Verizon got most of it.
Right.
So, here's the thing. In that situation, man, you have everything that's good and bad about America encapsulated in that. Verizon and AT&T's lobbyists worked their ass off.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Same time, Verizon and AT&T, from a public perception standpoint, from a brand standpoint, and from a business standpoint, they are tried and true, recognized purveyors and custodians of the pea, of the pot system. Again, something else that's not totally going to go away.
Right.
Right? And because of that, businesses, yeah, Google's doing well, but what are you guys going to do? You touch the online ads and have a search engine. No one thinks of Google, nor are they going to trust Google as a communication company like that, at least not business.
Sure.
So when you look at the policies of this country, when you look at infrastructure, you stand it past, you know, the failing bridge situation and collapsing, you know, in Minnesota, when you look at infrastructure, can you incorporate cyberspace and what that means?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and besides net trial and all the other stuff we did in that too. When you look at infrastructure from that standpoint, there was no way in heck they were going to allow Google to take control of that much of the infrastructure. It was not going to happen. As much as they would have wanted it to, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Basically now, Google generated a lot of hype. So they basically been put to the bathroom. Now, that being said, Google just goes down their list of options. It's like, okay, well guess what? They just need a network. The
right.
other thing that people don't realize is that they own a huge block of the IPv6 address.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they want to do that?
Yeah.
You could embed, you know, instead of using MAC addresses for devices, you could embed that insanely long 128-bit number, however big the IPv6 is, as your MAC address in a device. That could be the permanent ID for any particular given device.
Right.
And because it's an IP address, guess what? You can communicate with that a whole lot easier now.
Mm-hmm.
You can keep track of that stuff a whole lot easier. It's the same as a MAC address, just using a different technology that enables communication in a different way. So,
right.
when you look at, and we mentioned, I mentioned Sprint Nextel before, when you look at, you've got now Comcast and others trying to get into, they're getting them interested in the whole WiMAX thing and potentially they can provide funding to build out that network. Future's coming, baby, and it's coming hard. And the thing is that if they get that WiMAX network built up, I'm not going to say it's the end of the plain old telephone system, but people need to keep their modem couplers and decouplers around know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that people need to learn how to use that stuff because that's what's going to enable some other sorts of innovation. We can get it out a little later. We're not on this line. But yeah, they're building out these new networks. It's going to happen. Don't forget, Iridium's still in the sky. I don't think Bill got off satellites up there. But there's tons of crap floating around that people can use for communication. And the thing to keep in mind with this is that Google's going to find another way. Because if it just team with this whole WiMAX thing, it creates competition. What people were afraid of is that Google was going to establish some sort of wireless monopoly.
Right.
And
right.
be able to compete in a way that Verizon and AT&T just can't. And the last thing they want to do, you know, as much as the FCC wanted to break up AT&T,
right
now the last thing that they want to do is destabilize them any further and not allow them to go into the future because they are now a critical part of the infrastructure. A lot of that was governmental policy decisions.
See,
it had nothing to do with who was going to do the better job. That's just my opinion.
Think there was a bit of collusion perhaps between those two companies, you know, between Verizon and AT&T to make sure that, you know, they could outstand or outbid, if you know, Google. So I'm sure Google's got plenty of cash.
Right. There may not have been collusion between the two, but I think Verizon and AT&T were just better at manipulating Washington.
Oh yeah, I understand that. I can agree with that. I don't know if Google yet has the type of lobbyist and the necessary to do the deed, you know, of those type of things. I'm sure they don't have the experience that, say, a Microsoft lobbyist would have or a, you know, like you said, a telco lobbyist would have. You know,
right.
Yeah, I agree with that, definitely. But I thought that was...
Yeah, I mean,
and
that's... Yeah, that's all it is. They just have better relationships. This is what I deal with every day in terms of my job. If somebody has a better relationship than I do, they're going to make the person like them. They're going to sell. They're going to make stuff. People like buying things from people they like. And it's not that people... I don't think Google is respected, but I think people fear them more than they love them or they're comfortable with them because they're not tried and true.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the funny thing that a lot of people don't see. They just thought it was pretty curious, and all that noise that they're hearing about them with the 700 megahertz. In fact, I had written that in my paper, man. I was sure I found out that they didn't get the spectrum. I was like, damn. So that, I just knew there was going to be this new type of innovation that was going to force those wireless providers to get off their ass and become fair and equitable and kind of move. There's so many things that I want to move on, you know, into in terms of, you know, talking about this whole automotive space and how we drive today in this whole idea of intelligent transportation systems and you know, the problems that we have. I mean, it's really simple. I've been writing this paper, it seems like, for years now. I'm trying to finally get done so I can defend. But anyway, the whole idea is we got these stupid EMS, you know, virtual messaging systems that you see flashing before your eyes and drive down the highway and these aqueducts and tell you there's a collision 30 miles ahead. You know, be careful. There's no way for you to actually communicate that information real time with the guy 30 miles behind you because he doesn't see that the 19th sign that you just saw. So the problem we have is these cars are just the network. Cars are the network. The network is broken. I'm not talking about sending music to your buddy behind you. I'm talking about critical life-saving information and road conditions, road hazards, things of that sort that need to be communicated behind you, in front of you, inside of you, whatever the case is. That, I think, can be leveraged by wireless mesh networks, WiMAX, you know, Wi-Fi, you know, satellite as a backup, of course, I mean, GPS is a given. I mean, that's how we would be driving in the 2100 case. And I'm sure it's not going to take us that long to get there. But I think part of the problem is we have a history of greed when it comes to these wireless providers. They don't want to share the pipe. They don't want to collaborate. And it's going to take some of these companies that are not part of the clique, you know, to break up the stupidity. I thought that when I was going to Google to be down and do that. Somebody. It doesn't have to be Google. It could be anybody. But somebody could be down and do that.
Remember, Alfred, it's always been wherever a point where we let it head is this sort of thing. Kind of, I agree with you, but then I think Google's going to find another way. When they finally get everybody off of the old analog or the old network in that particular section, they're going to be able to come back to that. Mm-hmm.